As Israelis stepped up their bombing campaign, battle intensified. We thought Beirut burning under fire would shock the world, that the world will react to landing of a mortar al Burj al Barajna building in the city and the death of at least 75 innocent humans. We witnessed rallies in Algeria, but we later realized that they were just cheering for Algeria's victory against Germany in the World Cup.
Demonstrations were held across the Arab world because they thought Algeria's elimination from the World Cup had been a fix. But no one took to the street for the occupation of the second Arab capital after Al-Quds. Before the establishment of Hezbollah, Lebanon had seen several conflicts with Israel. There were two kinds of wars. Firstly, the partisan and army battles where national and Palestinian resistance groups were involved. And secondly, the battle fought by the Syrian army in the 1982 Lebanon-Israel conflict. In 1982, Israeli forces were double the combined number of troops Syria and Egypt had deployed in the October 1973 war. But Israel faced two different forms of resistance, military and non-military, in Lebanon. But how did Israel achieve victory against them? The natural elements of the Lebanese battlefield and its complex geography with its heights and narrow passes through the mountains left Israel no option but to employ new tactics. The strategy relied on heavy use of infantry and greater use of units than Israel dispatched for the 1973 war, but across a smaller area of only 70 kilometers. Israel used the maximum number of troops possible to take control of main crossways and sensitive points, overlooking key towns and cities, while taking hold of key geographical locations. To be able to reorganize its forces, Israel wanted a second portion of its troops to quickly advance towards Beirut, while the first groups had resistance forces encircled. The second group was to be supported by special forces, who would provide them with their needed equipment deep in Lebanese territory through marine or air transport methods. However, the Israeli army faced a demographic factor, a major geostrategic element in the war. They didn't have the needed experience to fight in urban and residential areas. Classic armies naturally avoid entering populated areas to prevent troop casualties, since such areas are full of buildings that limit movement. The Israeli forces were built upon heavy armored units supported by infantry, but Tel Aviv had not improved its infantry tactics, despite the fact that its troops had to fight face-to-face battles against popular resistance forces to be able to encircle them. The low number of Israeli infantry units gave the Lebanese and Palestinian resistance groups the opportunity of free movement and of engaging Israeli forces, though they failed to use the existing opportunity. The Lebanese National Resistance Front and the Palestinian Resistance Forces retreated as the classic Israeli army advanced into Lebanon, that was done in accordance with non-military principles without undermining their policy of confrontation. This is what Chinese leader and one of the most significant guerrilla war theorists, Mao Zedong, used to say. He said, "Escape when an army attacks you, confront it when it settles down, and follow it when it retreats."
Yasser Arafat used his entire experience of guerrilla wars. He had access to the experience of a full range of resistance movements, including those from Russia and Algeria, as well as weapons from across the globe. The Japanese also helped him along with their Red Army, German guerrilla group Badr-Menov Group, and Italy's Red Brigades. All of them sympathized with the Palestinian issue, as they had Arab countries' facilities at their disposal and even had interests in the Arab oil industry. The Palestinian resistance staged a hard-fought partisan battle since the very establishment of the Zionist regime. The battle had a history of ups and downs, both in Palestine and outside, including in Jordan and Lebanon. Therefore, it was not a domestic guerrilla war, and there is no partisan battle except that it gains victory. This is a historically recognized fact based on the experience of the wars of the past.
On October 6th, the Israeli army, equipped with large numbers of Merkava tanks, launched a pitched battle against Lebanon. Israeli forces began advancing along several axes with a focus on the coastal areas. One of the most important classic battles of the 1982 war took place here in this place, where Israeli and Syrian armies engaged in the Battle of Sultan Yaqub. During the battle, Syrian army forces inflicted heavy damage on Israeli armored personnel carriers that stopped them from advancing. In just 5 days, the Israelis managed to extend their domination to two-thirds of Lebanon. That was when they realized the road to Beirut was all clear. They were finally within kilometers of the Lebanese capital on June 9. On that day, Lebanon witnessed one of the heaviest air battles in modern times.
كان البقاع ولا يزال جزءا من النطاق الأمني السوري إلى دمشق وسوريا.
Beqa has always been part of Syria's security margin for Damascus. Therefore, Syria has to keep its security presence at the border town to make up for Lebanon's weak border security in the valley. If not, Israelis could use the Beqa area to enter Lebanon, while military forces in Bilad al-Sham, Greater Syria, which is 30 kilometers away from Beqa, could not defend the area. Therefore, Syria had to set up its defenses from outside of Bilad al-Sham and deployed its SAM-6 anti-air defense system to Lebanon to that end. The key issue here is that back in 1982, the Israeli enemies wanted both to get rid of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and prevent Arabs, especially Syrians, from repeating the victories they gained during the 1973 war. Arabs could reduce Israel's air superiority through creation of a semi-active air defense system, providing more ease of movement to Syrian and Egyptian forces. The advantage cost Israelis part of their air force and surprised them for a short period of time, providing the Arab side of the war with a sort of a victory. In fact, all of that was an achievement of the air defense systems of Egypt and Syria, especially the latter's, as Syrian soldiers used the air defense system with ultimate skill.
In June 1982, the Israelis resorted to destroying missile systems in an attempt to prevent limited successes of the Arabs in the October War. After the destruction of the air defense systems, Syrians deployed 100 aircraft to counter the Israelis' air assaults. The Israelis responded with ambushing the Syrian fighter jets. One of such tactics was the use of F-16 aircraft able to tackle air-to-air missiles of Syria's MiG-23 fighter jets, leading to the destruction of a large number of Syrian jets, up to 36 of them.
In 1982, the Syrian army faced a large-scale attack that led to many deaths. They forced Syria out of southern Beirut and the Jabal area and besieged Syrian forces in Beqa. They pushed the large Syrian contingent out of southern Beirut. The 85th Brigade left Beirut with its flag lowered due to a planned peace agreement. On the fifth day of the war, Israel ended the battle with Syria, setting the stage for talks.
This was the climax of the Israeli military doctrine's achievements. The doctrine proved to itself and to the world that it is effective and successful both against popular resistance movements and military tactics of classic armies, as it overcame both classic and non-classic methods of battle on Lebanese soil.
Palestinian resistance groups also did their best, including by volunteer operations, aircraft hijacking, and domestic operations, but they led nowhere.
Only then did a man emerge before the eyes of the world who said Israel had been trapped. Ruhollah. And at his hands and under his supervision, we were told of the auspicious birth of a unique form of fighting, comprised of the three elements of faith, jihad, and martyrdom, so that it sets out a new direction, which Ruhollah dubbed Hezbollah. The party of Allah, they will be predominant. And only a few years later, Yitzhak Shamir told the world that Hezbollah are only a different sort of Arabs.
The creation of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon shook the pillars of Israel's security doctrine. The Islamic resistance adopted a special method in the battle against the Israeli forces, which were defeated neither by classic armies nor in non-military battles. Hezbollah put up an unprecedented fight in the history of military science and overcame Israelis. The victory had nothing to do with the geographic elements, as the Palestinian resistance battled Israelis in the same environment. It was not also because Hezbollah was a Lebanese movement, as even the Lebanese and their popular movements fought Israel with the same weapons and on the same lands, but failed to defeat Israel. It was not the territory that gave Hezbollah the upper hand. As Palestinians engaged Israelis in the same territory, so did the Lebanese. Then what made the difference?
Tactic is the element that puts different forms of knowledge at the service of a battle. The more skillful and capable a commander, the fresher and more creative his military tactics would be. It means a capable commander's exceptional leadership and war plans are the results of defining the principles and rules of battle in a specific way. These two factors are in turn rooted in the commander's perception of the principles of war and his detailed assessment of the facts on the ground in the battlefield. The rules of battle can be both firm and flexible. Did Hezbollah develop a special tactic during its years of resistance? Is Hezbollah now in possession of a new technology they have adapted to the battlefield?
In theory, tactic is the knowledge of capabilities, technologies, and details. But in practice, tactic is the ability to create a link between creativity, flexibility, and moderate decision-making in the difficult conditions of the battlefield against a shrewd enemy, coupled with the commander's understanding of the human nature and the impact of the war on his soldiers. Therefore, when we say resistance shattered the enemy on the battlefield, it means the enemy was defeated on the three tactical, practical, and strategic levels. That was what led to the shattering of the enemy's national security doctrine.
Over the years, Hezbollah has been fighting Israel. The resistance developed a military concept of its own. Therefore, what it laid out in southern Lebanon was different from its entire experience of the past.
What we saw in the year 2000 was that enemy soldiers, its special forces and officers, as well as their whole military establishment, were present in Lebanon. However, none of them could give the slightest response to the operation by the resistance, which demonstrates any operation planned by the movement leads to victory, and nothing can be done to counter or stop it. This was the conclusion that led the enemy to retreat.
Israel was twice taken by surprise by Hezbollah. First, by Hezbollah's preparedness for war, and second, by its realization that what it accomplished in the past and the powerful means it used to make those accomplishments were no longer effective against such a well-prepared opponent. The July battle was different from all the past battles Israel had fought since its establishment. Military history proved the superiority of Hezbollah over Israel's military doctrine, which had earlier proved itself effective against the Arabs' both classic and non-classic warfare. Israel faced a new form of resistance, which was fledging back in 1982 and hit its climax in July 2006.
Some say the enemy was on the defensive before the year 2000. However, if we assume that invasion is the key decisive advantages in a war, it was Israel that had the advantage in 2006, as it was Israel that made the assault. We witnessed terrible scenes during the war. The enemy's performance was extremely poor. Researchers said the poor performance was rooted in Israel's failure to balance its forces and its reservists, as well as numerous other problems that made the true reasons behind Israel's failure. But the real reason for its defeat was the performance of enemy's soldiers and officers. Israel's military doctrine failed both in strategic and practical terms, while the failure was also visible in the different aspects of its military concepts and structure. Israeli military organization, soldiers, and officers were also unable to find appropriate methods to fight Hezbollah on the battlefield. But the more significant issue was the resistance movement's superiority to Israel in terms of its military doctrine, theory of the battle, and all strategic, practical, and tactical dimensions.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a question that a lot of people ask, and that question is regarding the permissibility of mourning and crying and grieving for the friends of God. In particular, grieving and crying and mourning the death of the Imams alayhi wasalam and the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasalam, which is a custom and a tradition amongst the followers of the school of thought of the Ahlul Bayt. In order to answer this question, it's necessary for us to take a look at the meaning of the word bid'at, or innovation. Because the people who say that this is impermissible, the reason why they say this is impermissible is that they say this is a bid'at, this is an innovation in religion, and we have traditions which indicate the fact that if a person begins a bid'at, innovation in religion, or acts upon it, then this person will be punished and he's going to go to hell, and it's a very grave sin. But when we look at the meaning of the word bid'at and we examine its concept, we see that the word bid'at is a word which has been used in contrast to the word sunnat. The word sunnat, it refers to the traditions, the norms of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which includes his actions, his words, and also his indirect acceptance of the actions of others. So therefore, bid'at would refer to things which don't have a basis in religion. This usage of the word bid'at has been mentioned in many traditions. For example, in one tradition narrated from the commander of the faithful, we see that the word bid'at has been used in contrast to the ordinances of God and the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. This tradition has been mentioned in Kanzul Ummal, volume 16, page 184. In any case, when we look at the tradition of the Holy Prophet, we see that in many cases he permitted and he even himself mourned the death and the martyrdom of certain individuals who were close to Allah and friends of God. For example, he permitted and even encouraged people to mourn the death of Hazrat Hamza, who was martyred in one of the battles of Islam. For example, he encouraged the women of the Ansar, the helpers, the companions of the Prophet, to grieve for him. He encouraged them, he prayed for them. If this is true for these individuals, such as Hazrat Hamza, it's even more permissible and true and recommended and noteworthy for us to mourn individuals who were greater than these individuals, such as our Imams, alayhi wasalam. There's no doubt in our minds, and everyone knows that the Imams, alayhi wasalam, they were greater in stature, in spiritual stature, and then these individuals in particular. So if it was permissible for us to mourn them, it's also permissible for us to mourn these people. In fact, we have numerous traditions which have been related regarding the permissibility of mourning for Imam Hussein, alayhi salam. The Prophet, many times, he gave news and predicted the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, and grief and sadness were manifested from him when he reported this. So in particular, for Imam Hussein, this is something that the permissibility of which we can derive from these traditions. Thank you for joining us on The Key. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Prosecutors are among the most powerful players in the criminal justice system. They can send a defendant off to years in prison or even to death row. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, "Who Will Hold Prosecutors Accountable?" Prosecutors are among the most powerful players in the criminal justice system. They can send a defendant off to years in prison or even to death row. Most wield this power honorably. Yet when prosecutors don't, they rarely pay a price, even for repeated and egregious misconduct that puts innocent people behind bars. But why? Because they are protected by layers of silence and secrecy that are written into local, state, and federal policy, shielding them from any real accountability for wrongdoing. New York City offers a prime example of a problem endemic to the nation. Consider the city's official reaction to the barrelful of misconduct in Queens that a group of law professors recently brought to light. As the New York Times reported last month, the professors filed grievances against 21 prosecutors in the borough for everything from lying in open court to withholding key evidence from the defense, and then posted those grievances to a public website. These weren't close calls. In every instance, an appeals court had made a finding of prosecutorial misconduct. In many cases, the misconduct was so severe that it required overturning a guilty verdict and releasing someone from prison. Three men wrongfully convicted of a 1996 murder were exonerated after 24 years behind bars. But that rectified only the most glaring injustice. To date, none of the prosecutors have faced any public consequences. Some are still working. How did New York City respond to this litany of widespread misconduct by its own agents? It went after the professors who publicized it. In a letter to the committee that handles misconduct charges, New York City's top lawyer, known as the Corporation Counsel, accused the law professors of abusing the grievance process to promote a political agenda and of violating a state law that requires formal complaints about lawyers' conduct to be kept secret unless judicial authorities decide otherwise. And they virtually never do. The grievance committee agreed to punish the professors by denying them access to any future updates on their complaints, even though state law requires that complainants be kept informed throughout the process. The upshot is that the committee could dismiss the complaints tomorrow and no one would know. For good measure, the Corporation Council then sought to keep secret the letter requesting the law professors be punished for violating the secrecy law. This isn't just shooting the messenger. It's tossing the gun into the East River and threatening anyone who tries to fish it out. We know about all this because the law professors sued the city in federal court, claiming that the secrecy law infringes on the First Amendment. How could it not? If someone tells a New York Times reporter about a prosecutor's misconduct, the reporter is free to write a story addressing those allegations for all the world to see. But if the same person files a formal grievance about the same misconduct with the state, she is barred from talking about it. It's not even clear what the punishment for violating the law would be, as evidenced by the fact that dozens of prominent lawyers, including former New York judges and even prosecutors, went public with grievances they filed against Rudy Giuliani over his role in Donald Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 presidential election and encourage the 6th of January riot at the Capitol. To date, none of these lawyers have faced public sanctions for speaking to the press. In theory, the secrecy law exists to protect lawyers from being smeared by frivolous complaints. But that rationale makes no sense when applied to prosecutors, who are public officials doing the state's work. In the Queen's cases, their misconduct is already a matter of public record. Even if it weren't, there is no principled reason to prevent the public airing of complaints, not to mention public hearings against officials who have the power to send people to prison. Certainly, the defendants they face off against in courts of law don't enjoy such privileges. New York shelters its lawyers from disciplinary measures more than most states in the country, even as it ranks near the top in total number of exonerations, a majority of which are the result of misconduct by prosecutors. Meanwhile, the few attempts to increase oversight of New York prosecutors have been stymied. A 2018 law established a commission specifically to deal with prosecutorial misconduct in a more independent and transparent way. But the State District Attorneys Association challenged it, and a court struck it down as unconstitutional. Lawmakers designed a new commission this year, but it appears that no commissioners have yet been appointed to it. New York's prosecutor protection racket is, alas, far from unique. In Washington, the U.S. Justice Department aggressively shields its own prosecutors from outside accountability thanks to a 1988 law that lets the agency essentially police itself. All other federal agencies and even parts of the U.S. Justice Department, like the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, are subject to oversight by independent inspectors general, who conduct thorough investigations and issue lengthy reports with their findings. Federal prosecutors skate by on an internal review process that is run out of the Office of Professional Responsibility, whose head is appointed by and reports directly to the Attorney General. The office almost never makes its findings public, and when it does, it often provides only a brief summary months after the fact. In the words of one legal ethics expert, it's a black hole. By contrast, the Inspector General's Office of the Justice Department just released its semi-annual report, as it is required to do by law, detailing the 52 reports it issued between April and September of this year, as well as the closing of investigations that resulted in 68 convictions or guilty pleas and 66 firings, resignations, or disciplinary actions. the level of scrutiny that federal prosecutors are subject to matters so much because they're just as prone to misconduct as their state and local counterparts. Take the botched prosecution of former Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska on corruption charges, or the legal green light Justice Department lawyers gave interrogators to torture terrorism suspects, or the more recent revelation that Jeffrey Epstein got a sweetheart deal in 2008 from his prosecutor Alex Acosta, who later became Labor Secretary in the Trump administration. Yet, in the latter two cases, the Office of Professional Responsibility found no misconduct. Alex Acosta was guilty only of poor judgment, the Office of Professional Responsibility said. In the Senator Ted Stevens case, the office found misconduct but said it was unintentional, and it let the prosecutors off with a slap on the wrist. Have there been other similarly egregious failures to hold prosecutors to account? Almost certainly, but we don't know because the U.S. Justice Department doesn't tell us. There is no principled reason for federal prosecutors to avoid the accountability expected of all public servants. Their exemption from the general rule was adopted in 1988 as a favor to Dick Thornburgh, who was then the Attorney General and had tried to derail the creation of an Inspector General for the U.S. Justice Department. Years later, Mr. Thornburgh admitted he had been wrong. This is a highly professional operation that goes where the evidence leads and is not directed by the way the political winds are blowing, he said at a gathering marking the law's 25th anniversary in 2014. I've come to be a true believer, he said. So have large numbers of Republicans and Democrats in Congress, a remarkable fact at the moment when the parties can't agree on the time of day. Their fix is straightforward. Eliminate the loophole in the 1988 law and empower the Inspector General to review claims against federal prosecutors, just as the office currently does in cases involving other Justice Department employees. A Senate bill co-sponsored by Mike Lee, Republican Senator of Utah, and Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, would do exactly this. Yet Attorney General Merrick Garland is continuing in the tradition of his predecessors by opposing any change to the existing system. Prosecutors can work in the interests of fairness and justice, but they can also cheat and destroy people's lives. They should be held accountable when they do that, both to vindicate their victims and to help ensure that they can't do it again.
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Well, the topic of this episode, like the previous one, as we promised our dear audience, is supposed to be, in fact, the invalidating agents that make the prayer void. Sheikh Javid, we have already talked about six of those invalidating agents, right? And let's continue talking about the rest of them.
Yeah, sure. Well, the seventh invalidating agent is to laugh during prayer.
Yes.
I think there's also a special word used. It's called guffawing. I'm not sure if that is the proper word, which you know, or laughter. Okay.
Yes.
Laughter. So it is haram to laugh during prayer. And laughing, whether it is, involuntary or controllable or uncontrollable, makes the prayer void, because laughing is prompted by something external to you, mm-hmm. Okay? So
it detracts.
Yeah.
Distracts person who's offering the prayer.
If you are laughing, it means you are not doing anything. You are not offering prayer.
Yes.
But there's one thing mentioned in the Rusala, and that says that if you're laughing without emitting any voice,
mm-hmm.
Now you are laughing silently within you and in your heart, but no voice is emitted, okay?
In like a smiling?
It's just like smiling, but okay, you might be giggling in your heart,
uh-huh.
Okay? But there is no voice emitted.
Yes.
So this does not make the prayer void because mm-hmm. there's no voice, okay?
I see.
You can say it's a kind of silent laughter. Mm-hmm. Okay, that will not harm the prayer. Mm-hmm. This is the seventh one.
I see.
We can go on to the next one.
Yes, the laugh, whatsoever it is, whether it is controllable or uncontrollable, makes the prayer void.
Yeah, it makes the prayer void.
So what about the eighth one?
The eighth one is, of course, as an obligatory precaution, if one intentionally weeps.
Yes.
Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if a person weeps silently or loudly over some worldly things, like, for example, he is praying and at the same time he is weeping, crying, okay, for worldly things. For example, if he has made an accident or he has lost his car, someone has stolen his bike, for example, and he weeps for the loss which he has suffered, obviously his prayer becomes void. But if a person weeps or cries for spiritual reasons, for other worldly reasons, of course his prayer is not affected.
As we have the reports of some of the mystics.
Yes, of course.
Have been doing so.
We have many. We have. I don't want to make mention of any people or any names.
Yes.
There are scholars who, while praying, wept during their prayers.
Yes.
And they emitted the weeping sound during their prayers. People could hear them weeping during prayers. That does not make the prayer, because they wept or cried in their prayer, not for worldly sake, because they did not lose anything, and they of course wept for not being able to worship God properly in the best manner as Almighty Allah deserves.
I see. Okay, Sheikh Jawed, what about the ninth invalidating agent for the prayer?
The ninth invalidating agent is to do anything which changes the form and the shape of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
For example, actions like clapping or jumping and doing such things obviously invalidates the namaz. You cannot offer a prayer and still start clapping. Mm-hmm. Because while you are clapping or while you are jumping up and down, of course you are not in a state of steadiness, you're not motionless, and of course you are clapping, you're not offering your prayer, so that is obviously an invalidating agent.
Okay.
And it is said that there is no harm in actions which do not change the form of namaz, like, for example, a brief sign with one's hand, okay, we talked about it, if you make a brief gesture with one of your fingers, or with eyes winking, like to communicate a message to someone, it does not affect the prayer.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Jawed. Let's stop for a very short break, and we'll be back and talking about the rest of those invalidating agents of the prayer. Stay with us. La ilaha illallah,
Allahu Akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islam Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawed, hosting this program, and Sheikh Jawed, our dear guest speaker. The topic is the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Before the break, and even previously, we started, in fact, our episode on some of those invalidating agents of the prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Would you please continue and talk about the, if I'm not mistaken, the 10th?
The 10th invalidating agent, of course. Eating and drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Eating and drinking make your prayers void. If a person offering prayers eats or drinks in such a manner that people would not say that he is offering prayer, his prayer becomes void. Regardless of whether he does it intentionally or, it's said that regardless of whether he does it intentionally or forgetfully, because if you are If you are doing it,
yes.
If you are doing it, you know, if you're eating or drinking something while you are praying, okay, people will start saying, okay, you're eating something and you're not praying. So your prayer becomes void. Now, if a person who wants to keep, it's said that if a person who wants to keep a fast is offering a mustahab namaz before
the recommended prayer.
Yeah, before the adhan of Fajr prayer, and being thirsty, fears that by the time he completes the prayer, it will be Fajr. He can drink water during that mustahab prayer. You know, of course, that's mustahab prayer. In the mustahab prayer, you can do things even if the prayer is
made. So it doesn't invalidate
the prayer.
Yes. Okay.
When it comes to obligatory prayers, of course, you cannot do it.
How about the 11th invalidating agent?
The 11th invalidating agent is that any doubt concerning the number of rakats, mm-hmm. okay, in those prayers which consist of two or three rakats will render the prayer void. Because if you are offering the Fajr prayer and you start doubting between two rakats and three rakats, or between one and two rakats, of course your prayer becomes void.
Exactly.
And the same is the case with prayers are consisting of three units, three rakats.
Like Maghrib prayer.
Yeah, like Maghrib prayer. If you doubt between two and three rakats, of course your prayer becomes void. Mm-hmm. So this doubt, there are many doubts which invalidate the prayer, okay? Mm-hmm. Inshallah, when it comes to doubts, we will have a separate session. We will talk about the doubts. There are many doubts that some of which are valid, some of the which must be ignored, mm-hmm. and some of which are correct. So
hopefully
that will be a separate issue.
And the last invalidating
agent? If a person omits or adds the rukn, elemental part or essential or basic part of the prayer, either intentionally or forgetfully, his prayer becomes void. Now, for example, you are omitting a ruku, or you are just ignoring, takbiratul ihram, or you are not doing qiyam mutasil baruku. Of course, your prayer becomes void. Or maybe if you add an extra rukun, like you read and you perform an extra ruku, then your prayer definitely becomes void.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers to these questions regarding the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And thank you, dear audience, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.